reports ethnic cleansing in Moscow. Of all the repression which has taken place after the September coup, by far the most outrageous has been the racist measures taken by the government to cleanse the capital on a racial basis. Immediately following the bashing of the White House on October 4th, special troops and regular police began a roundup of all illegal aliens in the city. Thousands were deported and many more thousands fled, terrified for their safety. The legal basis used for this mass operation was the propiska, or permit system, a relic of the Stalinist past which required citizens of the former Soviet Union to have a permit to live in Moscow or any other region stamped in their passport. Normally, this could only be obtained by birthright, a special invitation to study or work, or through marriage. For years, there was a market of fake marriages to get around the system. Without a propiska, finding work or a place to live in Moscow was virtually impossible. But in the last few years, as visa regulations were relaxed and as apartments began to appear freely on the market for rent, more and more people simply ignored these rules and came to live in Moscow. Most of these people are ethnically Russian, but also a large number of others have settled here, including many Armenian and Georgian refugees, many traders from Central Asia and China, and a great deal of Americans and Europeans. The operation to crack down on illegal residents, which resulted in over 5,000 deportations within the first 2 weeks alone, was targeted almost exclusively on dark-skinned peoples of the Soviet Union. There was no effort at all to conceal the fact that the prime targets in this operation were people first and foremost from the Caucasus and from Central Asia. Searches and identity checks were conducted on dark-skinned peoples as whites were left alone. This harassment of people of color has been going on for some time in Moscow, and indeed has always existed to a certain extent in the Soviet Union. Daily, people of color are stopped and harassed, often having to pay regular bribes to the police to avoid arrest. Now the government, using the pretext of the propiska system, have institutionalized this racism. Most Russians blame people of color, more specifically Caucasians, for the astronomical crime rate in the city. Government officials, police, and even the TV news claim that 80% of all the crime committed in Moscow is committed by Caucasians. If this figure is based on arrest records, it is because of the fact that these people are much more likely to be arrested than white-skinned people. The police and the government claim that they are fighting crime, but in a city where the Russian mafia carries on their business in the open, where law enforcement officials are famous for taking bribes, where police peddle guns, and where theft and corruption take place in the government, this is a laughable excuse. The general population has been, by and large, supportive of these deportations. Most Russians, newly impoverished, insecure about the future, etc., are seeking people whom they can blame and take out their frustrations on. Before the coup, the police had called on people to inform on their neighbors if they expected them of being illegal aliens. Hundreds of people called on the first day of the appeal. Now, 40,000 citizens have volunteered to help patrol the streets, keeping an eye out for crime and suspicious individuals. During the operation, numerous human rights abuses were reported. Most typically, people were grabbed and sent to detention centers, without being able to contact friends, relatives, their embassy, and often without a chance to argue their position. There have been reports of people having their possessions and documents stolen, and of one man having his papers bearing his refugee status torn up. Some people were sent to special work camps to earn the money for their trip home. Those who have been arrested and deported include people who were passing through Moscow or who had legal status. One businessman was arrested at a hotel as he tried to register, and 65 Chinese students were held and may still be deported. Embassies and businesses have reported harassment of their employees. Sometimes the scenes have been truly ugly. At one Moscow food market, Russian merchants reportedly helped police turn over the food stands, beat and arrest traders from Azerbaijan. The remaining vendors, now devoid of much competition, have raised the prices on their own vegetables. Although human rights groups have petitioned the government and foreign embassies have lodged their protests, the government is totally nonplussed. And why shouldn't they be when around them the major powers of the world carry on similar campaigns with impunity? Latching on the main theme of the 90s, Russia wants to bleach out its population and shut up its borders for those without money or those with dark skin. The rest are welcome.
From Amnesty International USA, November 1st, Tajikistan human rights crisis grows. In the remote former Soviet Republic of Tajikistan, a human rights tragedy is taking place almost out of sight of the rest of the world. Amnesty is calling on the U.S. government to press for human rights improvements there as a condition for full diplomatic relations. Since factional violence erupted in May 1992, conflict between forces divided along both political and regional lines have left up to 20,000 people dead and has displaced over 600,000 people in this country, which borders China, Afghanistan, and two other former Soviet republics. Abuses increased when a coalition government resigned in November 1992, and the current government was installed. In the last year, a number of people identified with opposition parties have been arrested. Scores of people, mostly unarmed civilians, are reported to have been extrajudicially executed by law enforcement officials or have disappeared following detention. Statements by law enforcement officials indicate that police have been authorized to operate on a shoot-to-kill policy in situations where less extreme measures might be sufficient. Prisoners are reported to be subject to torture while in detention. Among the cases known to Amnesty are these two. Musso Esoyev, a well-known film actor, was arrested and taken away last December by men in an armed personnel carrier 7 months after taking part in demonstrations against President Rahman Nabiyev. The next day, his body was found with over 80 bullet wounds. No one has been charged with the killing. Bozor Sobir, age 56, was arrested in March 1993 and remains in jail. The charges, incitement to illegal deprivation of freedom and attempting to inflame inter-ethnic discord, appear to stem in part from poems written by Sobir attacking Russia as an imperialist power. Sobir, considered one of Tajikistan's finest poets, is considered a prisoner of conscience by Amnesty International. Please write Ambassador Strobe Talbot, U.S. Ambassador at Large for the Commonwealth of Independent States. Please raise with him Amnesty's concern about extrajudicial killings, disappearances, and torture. Strobe Talbot, in room 7531, Department of State, Washington, D.C., 20520.
From London, Amnesty International reports on Afghanistan. Hundreds of Afghan asylum seekers risk forcible return. Governments in Europe, North America, and other countries appear to be ignoring the appalling human rights situation in Afghanistan, and hundreds of Afghan asylum seekers are at risk of being forcibly returned, said Amnesty International in a report issued today, October 26, 1993. At least one Afghan asylum seeker was forcibly returned to Kabul from Denmark in August. Danish police handed him over to armed guards in Kabul, and nothing has been heard of him since. Several other Afghans in Denmark are so afraid of suffering the same fate, they went on a hunger strike, literally sewing up their own lips between September 6th and 17th. But some still face deportation. Immigration authorities in other countries, such as Canada, are believed to be currently considering the option to deport Afghan asylum seekers. Many governments are laboring under the illusion that the change of government in Afghanistan has eliminated the risks that Afghan asylum seekers fear, when in reality new groups have been targeted for arbitrary arrest, home raids, rape, and even death, said the organization. Since the fall of former President Najibullah's government in April 1992 and the subsequent formation of the Islamic State of Afghanistan, the nature of the Afghan civil war has changed, causing new groups of refugees to flee. Fighting between rival Mujahideen groups has spread into towns which were previously unaffected by war, and people continue to die almost daily in Kabul and elsewhere. More than half of Kabul's 2 million inhabitants have fled or have been killed during the past year. Those who have fled include people closely associated with the former government, educated Afghan women in various professional capacities who had been forced to give up their jobs, academics and professionals opposed to the new political system, members of certain ethnic and religious minorities, and ordinary unarmed civilians fleeing the indiscriminate bombing of their homes and localities. In one instance in February this year, government troops are said to have taken sides with members of the Sunni party Ittehade Islami against members of the Shia party Hazb-e Wahdat Islami and killed unarmed Shia civilian men in front of their families, raped women, and set Shia homes on fire. Many Afghans have fled to neighboring countries, including Pakistan, where they have joined former Afghan refugees who do not feel safe to return to Afghanistan. Others have fled to seek protection in Europe, North America, and elsewhere. Some refugee camps in Pakistan are controlled by Mujahideen groups, and, in the past, dozens of Afghan academics living there were threatened with death and even killed for advocating an end to the Afghan conflict through dialogue and democracy, reportedly by extreme Mujahideen groups. As part of its campaign to end political killings and disappearances worldwide, October 1993 to August 1994, Amnesty International is calling on all parties in the conflict in Afghanistan to take urgent steps to end political killings. Such acts are prohibited under international standards, even in times of war.
The Friends Committee on National Legislation petitions for the Code of Conduct on Arms Sales. Dear President Clinton and members of Congress, we believe the United States should neither sell nor give any weapons or other military equipment to any government that 1. Abuses the human rights of its people, 2. Denies its people democratic rights, including the right to choose their government in free and fair elections, 3. Attacks its neighbors or wages war against its own people, and 4. Undermines international efforts to control arms. Legislation embodying this principle is pending in Washington right now. We appeal to you to make it law. 40 million people have died in wars around the globe since World War II. Many of them were killed by weapons manufactured in the United States and shipped to friendly dictators abroad. In fact, the United States has become the biggest arms dealer in the world. The last 3 times U.S. troops went into action, Panama, Iraq, and Somalia, they faced weapons and technology made in the United States. We believe that sending weapons abroad often kills more people than it protects. The following organizations and individuals have endorsed the Code of Conduct on International Arms Sales: the Alliance for Child Survival, Americans for Democratic Action, British American Security Information Council, the Center for Defense Information, the Center for Development of International Law, Church of the Brethren, the Committee for National Security, the Council for a Livable World, the Development Gap, Federation of American Scientists, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, the Foreign Bases Project, the Fund for New Priorities in America, Human Rights Watch, Institute for Food and Development Policy, Food First, the Mary Knoll Justice and Peace Office, the Mennonite Central Committee, the Catholic Social Justice Lobby, Peace Action, Psychologists for Social Responsibility, Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Project on Demilitarization and Democracy, the 2020 Vision National Project, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, the Women's Action for New Directions, the Westchester People's Action Coalition, the Women's Strike for Peace, and the World Policy Institute. Rainforest Action Network, Action Alert Number 89, October 1993. UNICAL joins Texaco in destructive Burma pipeline project. In the midst of an atmosphere of corporate withdrawal from politically repressive Burma, two U.S. oil companies have stepped up their Burmese operations, Texaco and UNICAL. Both companies have shifted their focus from onshore oil sites to offshore natural gas sites in the Martaban Gulf in the Andaman Sea. In order to move the gas, they plan to build a natural gas pipeline through some of Burma's most pristine tropical forests to Thailand. The proposed pipeline would have profound effects on one of the last remaining forest wilderness areas in Burma. It would also have serious implications for the Karen and other ethnic communities who have suffered gross human rights violations at the hands of Burma's military regime, the State Law and Order Restoration Council, or SLORC. This reserve, the Khazar Du Wildlife Sanctuary, dominated by Khazar Du Mountain, supports several endangered and vulnerable mammal species such as tiger, barking deer, rhinoceros, leopard, and elephant, along with a myriad of bird, reptile, fish, and flora species. Outside of the reserve area is a war zone where ethnic nationalities, including the Karen, Mons and Tavoyans indigenous people have been fighting against the SLORC and its predecessors for decades. In order for construction to begin, the pipeline range must first be secured by SLORC. This is an area which neither the Thai nor Burmese army has been able to control for more than 40 years. It is likely that securing, building, and defending the pipeline will involve violent military action and human rights abuses at the hands of the SLORC. It is common in such relocations that thousands of people are forced from their homes, enslaved, used as porters for the military, or exterminated in order to prepare the way for development. Once the area is secured, it will most likely be deforested in order to prevent rebel sabotage and to sell the valuable hardwood trees. This type of rapacious clearing of forest, violent invasion of indigenous areas, and gross human rights abuses will be made possible through the investments of oil companies such as UNICAL and Texaco in the U.S., Total from France, Nippon Gas from Japan, and Premier Oil from the United Kingdom. By investing millions of dollars in the pipeline, oil companies are legitimizing SLORC's brutal authority over Burma. This investment will also give SLORC hard currency to continue their military buildup that is used to suppress those fighting for democratic reform and protection of the environment. Kai Mander from the Institute for Global Communications reports October 31st. Woman Maquila worker on hunger strike, Mexican worker on hunger strike for human rights. Maria del Rosario Garcia is in desperate need of your help. She has been hunger striking for over 30 days after being fired from KNET of Mexico in Matamoros, Mexico, a subsidiary of Union Carbide. Chayito worked for KNET for more than 20 years. By Mexican law, she is entitled to compensation for each of those years. KNET is trying to get away with paying her one-third of that amount. The Mexican Workers Union, which represents Chayito, is telling her to accept their offer. This case is representative of the crisis women workers in Mexico are facing in the maquiladora industry. Chayito was fired because she has had to take sick leave to take care of her 2.5-year-old daughter, who was born with a congenital heart defect and defects similar to Down syndrome. Doctors have told her it was due to the conditions she had to work under every day of her pregnancy, because those toxic chemicals have been found in the baby's blood. This woman had no previous history of public struggle for justice for workers. Yet on her own, this single mother sees no other option for her 2 children than for her to hunger strike for her rights. She is determined not to stop until she is given the separation pay that the company is obligated by Mexican labor law to give her. The Manchester Anti-Consumerism Group writes, "For the past 2 years, in the manic lead-up to that major consumerist event of the year, Christmas, the anti-consumerism campaign has called a national no-shop day on the first Saturday of December. This is an invitation to you, your local campaign group, or just a bunch of friends to get together and plan an event for the third national no-shop day to be held Saturday, 4th of December, 1993. This year, it's become the International No-Shop Day. The aim of the day is to highlight the difference between what we need to live on and items we may want to buy but do not really need. As Gandhi said, there is enough in the world for our need, but not enough for our greed. This is increasingly obvious as levels of consumption escalate and population grows. There are only so many raw materials that the earth can yield. The oil supply is predicted to run out in less than 50 years. Large cash crop plantations are used to supply us with luxury goods, whilst denying millions in the South any land to grow their food on. Unspoilt fertile land is turned into wasteland in a few years. Ever-rising levels of pollution are now exceeding those which the planet can sustain. Energy is in short supply, with the West using 50 times as much per person as the Third World. Consumerism does little to increase our happiness. Televisions and cars are destroying communities. The excess amounts of food we eat is actually detrimental to our health. And then there's Christmas, when 1 million unwanted presents are thrown away and we eat until we can eat no more." In an article that appeared in the Washington Square News Tuesday, November 2nd, Francisco Rodriguez Burns writes, "Prominent author sides with union. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker and an assemblyman trumpeted New York University's clerical staff, who held a protest yesterday in front of Tisch Hall in letters sent to University President L.J. Oliva," union officials claim. Walker, in her novel The Color Purple, portrays the degrading life of a black woman in a sexist society, accused the university of being unfair to the New York University chapter of the United Staff Association, a member of the American Federation of Teachers, which claims its members are composed of 70% women and 60% people of color. "New York University should be a leader and educator, not an obstacle to workers," Walker said in the letter. "New York University's resistance to specific measures to cure the cancer of racism in hiring, transfers, and promotions is disgraceful." Walker added that spending the university's budget on computerized systems and construction while ignoring severe health benefits is arrogant, and demanding workers to pay more for fewer health benefits amid present national efforts is further impoverishing low-paid workers. She went on to criticize the university for supposedly giving workers no child care assistance. "This is a clear example of the feminization of poverty," Walker wrote. "Refusing the wishes of the majority of workers by accepting a union agency shop, which every other union on campus has, can only be explained as sexism and racism on New York University's part." Assemblyman Brian M. McLaughlin, Democrat from Queens, said Oliva has to be applauded for the past support that he has given his employees and that his support should continue. He wrote in the letter that he hopes the university bargains with Local 3882 in good faith, pointing out the numerous contributions the workers have made to the university. I am certain that together you can negotiate a fair contract and build the type of relationship with labor that will carry the university and its reputation for excellence, he wrote. Approximately 100 union members rallied outside Tisch Hall at 5 p.m. October 30th before attending a negotiating session with New York University officials. Union President Trudy Rudnick said that no progress was made. Rudnick also said that Walker and McLaughlin had given a new spirit to union members. The only proposal the university has given the union since Rowley's negotiations started September 1st has been a 3% salary increase. And finally, from Bill Doors, from the New York Transfer News Collective via Workers' World Service, Yeltsin opponents held in prison without bail. The rallying cry of the newly formed campaign in solidarity with labor in Russia is Free the Moscow 16, Stop U.S. Aid to the Yeltsin Regime. International protest activities are planned in support of the Moscow 16 around November 7th, the anniversary of the 1917 working class revolution that gave birth to the Soviet Union. The Moscow 16 are Russian opposition leaders who resisted Boris Yeltsin's tyrannical abolition of their country's elected parliament. For that crime, they have been charged with, quote, inciting a public disturbance with grave consequences. The 16 are being held without bail. They face up to 15 years in prison, and they can have no visitors. Among them are communists like Viktor Anpilov of Labor Russia and the Russian Communist Workers' Party. Anpilov is a Moscow City Council member. He fought from the start against the pro-capitalist, anti-working-class programs of Yeltsin and Gorbachev. Also among the 16 are nationalist parliamentary leaders Alexander Rutskoy and Rusyan Khasbulatov. Not partisans of the working class, Rutskoy and Khasbulatov supported Yeltsin in 1991 when he suppressed the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. But they were afraid to enact the shock therapy of massive layoffs, plant shutdowns, and price hikes demanded by Wall Street banks. For that reluctance, they have been targeted as hardliners by the U.S.-backed Yeltsin regime. And the 16 include army officers like Albert Makashov. He tried to defend Russia's Soviet constitution and elected parliament against Yeltsin's illegal coup. Yeltsin and the Clinton administration are scapegoating them all for the bloody events of October 3rd and 4th in Moscow. Yeltsin and Clinton described those events as an armed insurrection. In fact, it was an anti-fascist outpouring by tens of thousands of workers. The Yeltsin regime drowned it in blood. Yeltsin's forces gunned down hundreds of unarmed protesters in the streets of Moscow. Others died when Yeltsin's tanks fired point-blank into the parliament building. More would have died if the Alpha Commando Unit hadn't quietly ignored orders to murder everyone inside. According to an October 19 report in Izvestia, Russia's largest newspaper, the head of Yeltsin's Kremlin Guard ordered Alpha to shoot to kill, but the commandos instead brought parliamentary leaders out alive. Alpha officers told Izvestia that their superiors are angry that they avoided a bloodbath. Most plan to retire rather than serve as assassins. Quote, who will give us a guarantee that in 2 months, at the time of the elections, they will not want us to kill somebody? Said one Alpha member asked. Yeltsin's blatantly fascist actions shocked millions in Russia and around the world, but not the Clinton administration. Visiting Yeltsin in late October, U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher openly praised the October massacre. Christopher said it was justified because, quote, the parliament and constitution were vestiges of the Soviet communist past. U.S. Vice President Al Gore will pay a call to Yeltsin in December, and Clinton himself plans to visit the Russian dictator in January. An October 24th New York Times report on Christopher's trip showed who calls the shots in Russia now. The United States has prepared what a senior administration official called, quote, quote, a fairly comprehensive plan for the Russian parliamentary elections in December and the presidential elections in June. This has been Buzz Highwater and Daisy Freelander for Highwater Report No. 11, November 10th. The information from this report is gathered from miscellaneous.activism.progressivenewsgroup of the Internet.